Welcome back to Brandon Wilborn's Fantasy Fiction, where fans of classic fantasy adventures can hear the serialized audiobooks of a fellow nerd and indie author completely for free. I'm your author, narrator, nerd, and host, Brandon Wilborn. Thank you so much for listening. This is a big episode for me. The story portion of this episode starts just after the minute mark. Now for the recap. Last time in the Treasure of Caprick, Muna's magic brought forth an enormous red bull and a horde of demonic bugs. After despairing about their chances, Tobin's eyes were opened to the angelic warriors of the king's army standing behind their small band of villagers, and he got some hope. This week I'll be reading chapters 31 and 32, which will complete the story for The Treasure of Caprick. After that, I have an update on where things are at with the sequel and what's happening with the podcast from here. I do hope you'll stick around for that, because if you're still listening, it probably matters to you, so you don't want to miss it. Now I present for your enjoyment, The Treasure of Caprick. Chapter 31. The Routing of Evasius. The mysterious fighters on the hillside broke the stillness first. As they charged the left flank again, the group on the bridge saw the colorful figure of Adaminster turn his horse and run, his blue velvet cape flapping in the wind like a flag in the storm. Half the cavalry on his side of the battlefield followed him, and chunks of the infantry chased after them in a rout. The giant locusts began to swarm above that part of the battlefield, driving the five fighters back toward the hill. The bugs landed all around them, and from behind their wings came long tails with many joints. They raised them above their heads and lashed out at the warriors with the sharp tips. The fighters formed into a circle to protect themselves, and the monsters soon surrounded them, with a second ring of infantry completing the trap. Kurian watched, wondering why the blazing riders atop the hill did not move to protect these few allies. What were they waiting for? Then it came to him, in that deep, quiet whisper that was becoming familiar, which sometimes felt like another voice leading him, and sometimes like his own desire. "They're waiting for you. To be king, you must learn to command." Beneath him, the horse tensed. One of the locusts found a gap in the defenses and struck one of the strangers. He wavered but did not fall. All thoughts of a plan or strategy left Kurian's mind. They weren't necessary with the immense force of burning champions behind him. Immediately he called out, "We must help them. Go, go now. Hold nothing back." The horse leaped forward toward the gap in the bridge, and he was the first one onto the field. But before him, the ranks of ethereal combatants raced forward. Behind, the defenders of Apaford ran to catch up. The archers in the strange two-wheeled carts poured over the river and began attacking Evasius's right side, while the golden riders on the hill came down upon the left flank like an avalanche. A swath of Evasius's cavalry bolted in all directions, some directly into the coming onslaught, but most in retreat to the south and west. Evasius's own horse looked like it was barely under his control. With the thunder of the king's army bearing down, the fat witch dissolved into crows again and took flight north. The one in black rode the bull toward the oncoming army with infantry following. She cast dark shadows like billows of smoke before her, which began to obscure the battlefield. But the warriors of light dispersed them with a wave of their swords, which caused a great gust of wind. The witch waved her arms feverishly, with no effect on the force bearing down on her, and finally, she turned and fled, riding her beast. It moved with impressive speed and broke a great bloody swath through the center of the army, oblivious to the harm it caused to her allies. Kurian saw all this in a brief moment and urged the horse on. He felt like it flew across the field faster than ever, but before he closed the gap, the stricken man fell. The locusts jumped onto his body like a hungry pack of dogs. Two of his comrades leapt forward to drive them back, and they also fell, the bugs piling on them in a gruesome frenzy. Then the golden riders cut through the surrounding enemy to the remaining two and surrounded them in a wall of flaming horses and spears. The infantry attacked, but could not stand their ground. while the locusts buzzed overhead, staying just out of reach. Finally, he reached the hill and found he had been screaming for the entire charge. His sword was in his hand, and as he came down on the writhing pile of monsters on top of the fallen men, he swung. A wet crunching broke from the tip of his blade as it sliced into the wings and carapace of the creatures. They let out ear-splitting shrieks and shuddered on the ground in hideous death throes that left their legs twitching erratically. As he passed, he saw that the bodies of the warriors were only tatters of carcasses. He could not save them. Tobin and Rhys followed close behind and dispatched the remaining bugs in the pile.
"Well met, friends," shouted one of the remaining fighters.
He was a tall man, as tall as but leaner than Gideon. He huffed out the words as if winded from fighting. Beside him, his companion kneeled as if in prayer. All across the field now, there was skirmishing between the army, bolstered by the locusts, and the blazing warriors of the king. The band of eager townspeople fought in the center of the fray, each one of them supported by the great fighters on either side. Kurian came around in a wide arc and charged straight toward the ring of infantry from behind the line. He pointed his sword at the enemy and then waved it to one side. The golden cavalry pushed forward and made a hole, as if he had spoken a command. He rode into their midst, yanking on the reins, and came up beside the two fighters, with his three friends right behind him. The hole closed, and Kurian dropped down. Immediately, the larger fighter kneeled as well.
"Well met indeed, my sovereign. Thank you for aiding us."
"No need for that," Kurian said, panting. "You came to our aid first. I don't know where you came from, but I thank you."
The man rose and grasped his hand.
"My king, certainly you know of the assemblage of protectors whose compound this was. I awoke with my compatriots within the hill and emerged to find this army marching against Viverford. In truth, I believed they had destroyed our compound. But then I saw the destruction was not so recent. Has so much changed that it has been razed?"
"Much has changed," Kurian said, "for we are among the last of those protectors. Please, tell me your name."
"I am Ward, son of Eric of Finlay. My friend is Sage, son of Aaron, Bishop of Bennett. We are yours to command."
Ward Finlay bowed, and Kurian nearly stumbled back in shock. Tobin let out an emphatic grunt of surprise. It explained their archaic-looking armor and weapons, and their sudden appearance atop the hill. Here stood the founders of their order, the two closest advisors of King Frederick, raised from the tomb reserved for all the dual leaders of the compound.
"I am honored to meet such great men," Kurian said.
Tobin and Rhys both dropped down and saluted Ward.
"Forgive me, sovereign, but I do not know you."
"We were recently novitiates of the order. This is Tobin Hart and Rhys Brock. Our other companion is Louise Prescott. I am Kurian Abramson."
"Well met, friends," said Ward.
His eyes flitted upward in thought.
"Abramson, then you are of the line of the Prince of Bezor," he said to Kurian.
"That knowledge was lost to my family. The king merely said I had royal blood."
"By your standard, I had hoped you were him. I long to meet him."
A hope so deep it looked painful flashed across his face as he gazed on Kurian's shield.
"What of the line of King Frederick?"
"I'm afraid they failed long ago," Tobin said sadly.
"Enough talk for me,"
Ward said, lifting his sword and resting it on his shoulder.
"If you would order it, and if my friend is finished praying, we will deal with this would-be usurper."
Sage Bennett remained on his knees during the entire exchange, but his eyes were shut with such clear straining, and he prayed with such fervor that nobody thought it right to disturb him.
"God moves when he wills," the priest said in a clear voice.
"I'm ready to move when he is," Ward said.
A smile played at the corner of Sage's lips. Clearly this was an old joke between friends. The noise of the battle continued to rage. Even though Evasius's forces fell in great numbers, they continued to fight with the power of an intense hatred. When the priest finally lifted his head, the hair stood on the back of Kurian's neck. The air suddenly felt charged, and he saw a dense cloud forming over Capric Hill.
"Sovereign?" Ward said expectantly.
"Yes," Kurian sputtered. "Join in the battle, friends."
Ward rushed to the front of the line of golden warriors encircling them and quickly cut down three soldiers. Sage closed his eyes and gestured to his right. A blast of lightning thundered to the ground outside the circle. Soldiers flew back in all directions. The horses jumped, and Kurian smelled the strangest odor, as if the air burned.
"Forward,"
he called as he remounted his horse. The warriors in their ring of protection broke apart and wrapped around the end of Evasius's troops. They pressed forward, hewing down soldiers left and right. Now the army of Pollingham was engaged on three sides, nearly surrounded. The king's warriors filled the plain, and still some waited in reserve in the town. Evasius himself rode back and forth in short bursts, shouting commands and waving his arms frantically. Kurian felt pity for him, and yet he had refused the offer of a peaceful resolution. Kurian's army continued to press forward on all fronts, compressing their enemies into a tight mass of bodies with no room to maneuver. Bolts of lightning punctuated the struggle, with showers of sparks and peals of thunder as Sage Bennett moved forward with his thunderhead. As the wings of his army wrapped further around the jumbled huddle of their enemies, more and more of the soldiers deserted and fled. Finally, just before the wings closed, Evasius's horse stood in a moment of perfect stillness. Kurian saw his face less than 100 yards away. It showed only rage and hatred, though Kurian thought he appeared reserved to his fate. Then he yanked on the reins, turned around, and fled back toward Pollingham Castle. The moment their lord and commander abandoned them, the rear half of the army tried to rush through the narrow gap as well, but only a few hundred escaped. Those on the front lines gradually began dropping their arms and falling to their knees in submission. Dozens of the locust creatures remained buzzing in the air, and they flew off in every direction when Evasius deserted his army. At first, some of the villagers continued to attack, but Kurian rode quickly to them, shouting to stop.
"No, anyone who surrenders lives."
"What about Evasius?"
Gideon called above the cries for mercy.
"He's not our concern now. Not today," Kurian replied.
He considered the westering sun as Evasius turned into a distant shadow and then winked out of sight. Above the battle, the cloud Sage Bennett had summoned dissipated, and the charge left the air. Now he saw the light was changing again, growing more intense and lighting the air with the colors of flame as it had done in the early morning of this long day. Kurian felt tired. Tired and grateful. Kurian looked around at the battlefield. The bodies of thousands of Evasius's soldiers and hundreds of the bug carcasses lay on the grass of the plain, staining it red. He could not count them all. But as far as he could tell, only the three resurrected monks had been slain among those who fought with him. Over 1,000 of Evasius's soldiers now kneeled on the ground before him. The guiding voice inside him was silent. He would have to consult his friends, old and new, to discern what to do with them all. Chapter 32 Viviford. Noman woke to a sky smeared with hazy oranges and purples, unlike any colors he had ever seen. It drew him to the gap in the walls of the camp, through which the rushing, roaring river now poured over the edge of the cliffs. 2,000 feet below, it lapped and foamed at the walls of Dury before continuing over the plains to the sea. To the west, the sun was a burning half-disc of gold on the horizon. The sharp edge of its light had dulled, even as it appeared bloated beyond its noontime size. He was confident that he did not need to pray for its return the following day, but he did ask a blessing for his old students, now his friends, somewhere on the plain. When he did, A sense of peace passed over him, and he trusted they were safe.
"How do you like this new world we have?" asked Xander behind him.
He was not sure he would ever learn to like the way his new friend started a conversation, often sneaking up and speaking unannounced, but it no longer set his teeth on edge.
"Isn't it just a return to the way it was intended to be?"
Noman teased.
"Yes and no," Xander said,
leaving the air thick with possible implications.
"It's extravagant," Noman said. "I could spend a lifetime looking at a sunset like this and never stop wondering at it."
Xander nodded silently, looking toward the west.
"Any word from the plains?"
"Not yet," Xander said.
He pursed his lips and laid his hands on his walking stick, then rested his chin on top of them.
"The king has gone into the wilderness alone. I fear it will be one of his longest journeys, and I won't see him again before I sleep in the ground." "I hope you are wrong, my friend. Someday I would like to see him face to face."
Noman felt like there was nothing else for either of them to say to console each other, so his mind turned to practical matters.
"How are the captives?"
"Safe, for now. Most of their minds will heal under our care. Although this Captain Fallon, I have never seen anyone resist the king so effectively. We must watch him every moment."
Xander gestured back toward the camp.
"Would you like to take a turn?"
"If you don't mind, I'd prefer to stay in the healing house,"
Noman said and cleared his throat.
"There is so much I could still learn from Carissa."
"I'll bet there is,"
Xander said with a knowing smirk. Noman normally would have found the comment offensive, considering that he was a monk. Then he remembered that those vows no longer bound him, and Xander's insinuation made him curious. There was a spark of interest there, and he would be free to discover the potential in the proper time. It was a feeling of freedom he had never known.
"Nobody answered your question last night," Xander said,
changing the subject.
"They were all preoccupied with the fight, and I believe young Tobin was overwhelmed at the changes he saw in you."
"What question?"
Noman asked.
"About your name," Xander said.
That brought the memory back, but Noman was silent. Xander took his eyes off the sunset for the first time and looked him squarely in the face.
"Newman is a fine name. In the days to come, I pray more men are made new, and I hope you will have a hand in making them so."
No words of thanks were strong enough to express the gratitude he felt for everything that Xander had taught him in their short friendship. As he struggled to find them, he sensed they were not necessary. Xander already knew his heart. His mentor's wrinkled brown skin blurred into the background of the sandstone walls as the light failed, but he could see the white teeth grinning at him. He turned to look at the final moments of light on this day he would remember forever.
"Let it be,"
he said, just as the last portion of sun dipped below the horizon. Before nightfall, and with Sage Bennett's help, Kurian struck a deal with those soldiers who surrendered. If they helped bury the bodies of the other soldiers and burn the carcasses of the locusts, they would be free to go. Kurian was surprised that both Tobin and Gideon objected because they might return to Lord Avacius. But after witnessing his cruelty and bloodlust, Kurian believed most of them would try to find a quiet place to start a new life. Dozens of the soldiers tried to pledge their allegiance to Kurian as king. He accepted their pledge, but would not allow them to remain in the town. He was not ready to trust such convenient oaths, which could just as easily be broken. They would have to start afresh as well, ready to fulfill their promises if he ever called upon them. The people of Apaford wanted to celebrate their victory, and so did he and his friends, but after a day that felt like it had lasted for weeks, they had traveled a distance that would normally have taken that long. They were all too tired but to settle for a hearty, home-cooked meal and then bed. Kurian fell asleep near an open window, gazing at the flowers in the meadows of heaven, twinkling out like his first star, but in innumerable variations. Even the light-infused rain during his illness had not been such a balm to his soul as this peaceful vision of the night sky. In the morning, he gathered the townspeople in the main square, along with as many of the soldiers as could fit. He stood on an old door laid across the town well to address them.
"Not all of you saw the same events yesterday, but I think we can all agree that the outcome of the battle was miraculous."
He expected a cheer, but everyone was silent, waiting for what he would say.
"For anyone who desires to end the tyranny of the Evasians, it was a victory worth celebrating. For those loyal to him because of fear and intimidation, perhaps it was a relief. I told you I was sent to oust him from the de facto throne his family took for themselves. The one who sent me asked me to restore the throne of Finn, and to build it into something even greater than King Frederick achieved. Lord Evasius was defeated yesterday, and he fled, not leading his men in an orderly retreat, but thinking only of saving his own life. We weakened him, but that defeat does not end his power. However great a victory it was only a beginning. I intend to see that work through. Any who wishes may join me. But I warn you that it will be a long and difficult road, and I cannot promise that we will always have assistance as we had yesterday. I only promise that I will walk through all those trials with you, as your equal, suffering the same difficulties, and asking no favors as your expectant king. There is no need for decisions or pledges now, because I am certain we will have at least a few days of peace while we finish cleansing this place. A few days in which we can work side by side, and you can see my heart."
They looked at him with confusion. They did not know how to respond to such a speech. If they had ever heard one at all, it had been from someone like Evasius or Fallon, who spoke only of the sacrifices necessary from those beneath them. So the crowd was silent for several moments. On a whim, he placed his fists on his hips and spoke again more forcefully.
"Actually, if you do not object, I will indulge in one royal privilege."
A few groans came from the soldiers, as if they knew it had been too good to be true. He gestured toward Ward Finley.
"My new friend tells me that long ago this river had a different name. Before it dried up and earned the name of Unfaithful Apos by withholding the life-giving water from the land, the people of the plain called it the Vivis. This town, which straddled the river and thrived because of it, was called Viverford. For my first act as unofficial king, I would restore those ancient names in the first city reclaimed for Finn. Do I have your agreement?"
The crowd still stared in bewilderment. A ruler was not supposed to ask for permission to do anything, but many seemed to like the idea. The ancient warriors who founded the order both gave approving nods, and Ward squinted an eye as if he meant to wink, but found it distasteful for a man of action.
"Let it be,"
Tobin shouted from beside them. A few in the crowd voiced agreement, and soon the entire multitude was shouting the phrase.
"Let it be," they shouted, and with each repetition more voices joined in until the whole square echoed with it.
Kurian smiled, nodding with the rhythm of their voices, and held up his hands until they settled down. Then he caught Louise's eye, and she too smiled broadly at him. That smile roused his tired spirit more than the crowd's approval.
"Very well," he said over the crowd. "It shall be."
Then he drew his sword and held it high.
"To Viverford, first city revived among the 10 cities of the plain. First glimmer of hope for the renewal of Finn."
A roar of joyful agreement came from the crowd, washing over him as tangibly and forcefully as the current of the river. He could barely contain the emotions that surged through him as wave after wave poured forth. The whispering voice finally returned, the same one that had woken him from his poison-fed sleep, the one that lovingly nurtured the tender bud of hope in his heart. It spoke silently in his spirit, but could be loud enough to drown out all other voices. It was almost the voice of his own heart as he had always known it, but it had mingled together with another voice, one he was beginning to recognize as the resonant utterances of the king prophesying in the cave. It said only three words, but they came in a way that felt as if they could feed his heart through a decade of hopeless struggle.
So it begins.
Well, the king's army helped Kurian achieve victory, but Evasius is still a powerful man who will resist Kurian's efforts to become king in Polygam. To find out what happens next, you'll need to wait for Book 2 of The King of the Caves to be published. It's something I've been working on, and that brings me to the update. First, I want to thank you for listening to my story. This is the conclusion of The Treasure of Caprick. After a little more editing, it'll be released as a full audiobook. The ebook and print versions are already available at major retailers, where you can also find a follow-up novella about a rescue attempt for Captain Bacchus, the sailor who jumped ship to chase the sirens. That novella is called Siren Silence, The Fate of Captain Bacchus. At my website, brandonwilborn.com, you can find a story about the founding of the Caprick Order that happens to be about the two monks who sprang from the grave, Sage and Ward, in this last chapter. You'll get it for free when you join my email newsletter. Now for the question you may be asking. What happens next with the podcast? And to that, I have to admit that the podcast has been an effort of both love and endurance. I've really enjoyed reading the book and giving voice to the characters. It's been a lot of fun. But the editing process has taken up way more time than I expected, and it's time that I would have used to work on writing. So if I don't continue writing, then there's no more story to read, and therefore no more podcast. So one of these things has to give. I'm sad to say that the sequel is far, far beyond the schedule that I originally intended, and the podcast didn't help. Bad Brandon, lesson learned. So this will be the last episode of the podcast for the foreseeable future until I can get a better grasp on my writing schedule and how to make that flow and work in a way that allows for time to podcast. Or maybe in the future we might look to a Patreon or a Kickstarter campaign so that I can spend the time to do the recording but let somebody else do the editing, or heck, maybe even get a professional to do the whole thing. On the bright side, I am opening up time for writing by finishing this. And after shaking off the mothballs with some shorter pieces, I hope to re-engage with Kurian's story this year in the full-length sequel titled The Crownless King. If you'd like to receive the most up-to-date information about the progress, it will come through my email newsletter, since I haven't used social media for my writing in quite a while, and if you listen to some of the bonus sessions, you know why. It's free to sign up for the newsletter at brandonwilborn.com. Remember, it's brand on, not brand off, and Wilborn is as simple as you can make it. Wilborn, no extra vowels or L's. And when you sign up for that newsletter, you'll get free stories, as well as a regular link to collections of free books from me and other authors, and the occasional giveaway. This past Christmas time, I gave away a free Kindle. If you're still listening by now, I do want to sincerely thank you for coming with me on this journey. And I'd love to hear if you have any comments or questions or anything else related to the story or the podcast. You can send me a message or leave me a voicemail by going to brandonwilborn.com/contact. And as we end this book, let me say, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord turn his face toward you and give you peace. That's all for this week. Until next time, Godspeed. The Treasure of Caprick is also available in print and ebook formats from all major booksellers. Find a link to your favorite retailer in the show description or go to brandonwilborn.com.
That's brand on, not brand off, and Wilborn is as simple as you can make it. WILBORN. This has been The Treasure of Caprick, Book 1 of The King of the Caves, written and narrated by Brandon M. Wilborn. Copyright, Brandon M. Wilborn.